Hello, everyone. There's a lot of people here. The one question that is burning in my heart today that I will not leave here until I find the answer to is, why did David Housen lose so much blood that he passed out? That sounds awful. And I'm sure I'll hear the story. It's probably something that I'm supposed to remember and don't remember. But I'm glad he seems to have gained it back anyway. That's a good thing. When I was little, growing up in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, across the border from Youngstown, I had a cube that I really liked when I was a little guy. And this it showed up in a Christmas stocking one year, and it was something that my parents thought I would like, and they must have known me pretty well because I did like this cube. It was made out of wood, and it was from the country of Japan. And back in those olden days when Mark Graham was a little boy, if something was made in Japan, it was considered cheap and shoddy. But that's not true of all Japanese things. It certainly isn't today, and it hasn't been throughout history. This was really kind of a work of art. There were six sides on the cube, normal cube, and on every side there was wood inlay and paintings, and there was a different scene on every side, and the cube was jigsawed into 12 separate pieces so that it came apart and you could put it together, and the puzzle itself was fun. But then just looking at these six scenes, which were, you know, not real detailed, they were pretty simple because it was wood inlay, but I was just amazed that some human being on the other side of the earth had taken all the trouble for this little piece of wood, which probably cost $1.99 at Grant's in those days, and had ended up in the hands of a seven-year-old in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. And it was beautiful, and I loved it. Loving it for a little kid isn't the same as taking care of it. We threw it around, and I remember one little nubbin broke off. There was one side that had a sailboat scene on it, and one of the little jigsaw nubbins broke off. But I still liked it, and then it disappeared. We moved quite a bit, and I didn't know what happened to it. But as Taya has pointed out, eBay exists so that Mark Graham can rebuild his childhood. And one day, on eBay, I saw a wooden cube that had six scenes on it, and I sent for it, and it was mailed to me from Western Pennsylvania, and on the sailboat side, one of the little nubbins is missing. Now, I don't know. You know, there's no proof. And it's faded over the years. This was several years ago. It sat on our piano for probably 10 years now. But I love this cube. And it has just the fact that someone would take the time to inlay the wood and paint it and sell it for nothing to rich people across the ocean who wouldn't care for it enough to even not throw it at their brothers from time to time. But there's something about this that just lights a fire in my heart and fills me with wonder. And I really have always loved this cube. And as Taya has observed, eBay has fueled many of my obsessions since then. And her term for it is that I'm recreating my childhood, but it isn't quite that. And the reason I know that it isn't quite that is I have purchased some things on eBay. The first thing I ever bought, and Gene Weber has enjoyed this too, it was a guidebook to the 1964 New York World's Fair, which was the absolute highlight of my childhood. And talk about days filled with wonder. One of the strangest parts was that I would have been 12 years old when we went there, and my brothers would have been younger, and my parents paid our admission and just set us free to roam on Long Island, New York, with thousands and thousands of other people, and didn't worry about us. And we went from one pavilion to the next, looking at great works of art and architecture and foods that we'd never encountered, and technology that was out of this world. I saw my first computer there, and got a pen pal through this computer from India, whom I wrote to for a few years, and that is one of the things in my childhood that when I think of, it just kindles a flame inside my heart. But I have gotten things on eBay where I look at them and I remember them from my childhood and I go, eh. And they make their way to the Salvation Army thrift store down the block because they just don't do it for me for some reason. It's not a matter of rebuilding my childhood, but I began to pay attention to what I was doing at that point too, because I've been very curious my whole life. I think human beings tend to be this way, so it's not just me, but I get an obsession every 6 months or so, whether it's an accordion or whether it's orchids or a car or something like that. And I can tell when I have an obsession because from the vicinity of our living room couch, I hear, and it's Teo wondering how much money I've spent this time and does she need to be there when it arrives? Is it something living that she needs to bring in right away? But I do have these obsessions, and I've learned, it kind of reminds me of that Richard Dreyfuss actor in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where he starts building replicas of Devil's Tower in his mashed potatoes and with his kids' clay and things. He doesn't quite know why, but he does it. And that's of interest to me. I started paying attention to what my obsessions are because I wondered why I like them and where they lead and things like that. As you could guess, I've been obsessed with music and musical instruments. Nature has been an obsession since I was a little kid. I remember when I first saw seeds sprouting, just the wonder in my heart. I couldn't believe what a miracle that was. I sprouted seeds for giant sequoias and cedars of Lebanon. They are all dead nowadays, but you know, these giant creatures that could be grown from just a little seed. And eventually, my mind was led down the path through all these things and wonders. I began to see patterns in the universe, and you have your own story for this kind of thing, that led me to God and led me to His way of truth. I don't know what to call this. And so I am calling it, and you may entitle this today, The Path of Wonder. But that's not exactly the right words. It's just the words that I latch onto in my mind. I remember at one point that my sister got a book of Walt Disney's Sleeping Beauty with illustrations this big. I mean, it's a big book. I have it. I got it on eBay. But I have this book, and even as a little kid, I was very worried about this because I had some obsession with this book, and it was a Disney princess, after all, and I've seen the movie since then, and it really isn't one of Walt's great ones. I mean, it's kind of dull and dumb. But I finally realized that what I liked in it was the trees. That there was an artist named Ivan Earle who did art direction for Disney, but has done other artwork too. We have an Ivan Earle in our house. He's an artist that I like. And what he did when he painted these trees was somehow he put his soul into it. I don't know how he did it, but these trees have purpose and meaning. And I realized, I looked today at some of those illustrations, that what it was those trees lit some kind of fire in my heart. And trees eventually led me to forestry school. And forestry school eventually led me to Dave Crabtree. And Dave Crabtree eventually led me to the Plain Truth magazine, etc., etc., etc. As I said, we all have our own story. But somehow my mind was pulled along this path of wonder. And we'll use the word wonder, although there are other words. Wonder is an easy word and one that we pretty much understand. Another word that has a similar meaning is numinous. How many of you do not know the word numinous? Yeah, that's the way. It's not that kind of word. You don't work it into too many sentences, do you? But numinous is a word that various philosophers have used, and one of its meanings is having a strong religious or spiritual quality, indicating or suggesting the presence of a divinity. But another definition is surpassing comprehension or understanding, mysterious. And Carl Sagan, the astronomer, used the word numinous to describe his reaction when he started exploring the heavens. And other words that come into use on this kind of thing are transcendent. and awe-inspiring, and even holy in a way, because although holy, you know, you look into the roots and it, one of the meanings for holy is set apart, but still, along with holy, there's this awe and this inspiration and things like that. Beauty is part of it, and surprise is part of it. Not knowing what's coming and being delighted by something that you've never thought about or seen before. Mystery is part of it, and I'm summing up all those things in the inadequate word, wonder. The path of wonder. And people through the ages have had this path in their minds, whether they have followed it to God or not. Let's look in Proverbs, Proverbs 30, and verses 18 and 19, and this is just one small example. I mean, you could find many, many examples outside the Bible that would illustrate this kind of thing, but Mr. Thomas insists that I quote scriptures from time to time, and so we'll go to Proverbs 30, verses 18 and 19, and bear in mind, this was written by King Solomon, and he may have been a child of God, and he may not have been. We don't know what the ruling is on that, and we won't know until the world tomorrow. But here are his words in Proverbs 30, verses 18 and 19. There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. And of course, there's many, many other things in the universe, but these are just some of the things that puzzled him, and yet he knew were beautiful. He didn't understand, and yet they lit some kind of fire in his mind. God is referred to as a God of wonders. One of the first places that he's referred to that way is in Exodus 15 and verse 11, which of course has to do with the story that we go over every year at this time, the nation of Israel leaving Egypt. And this is one of, and I'm not kidding, hundreds of references to the wonders that God did and that Jesus Christ did. So this is just where it begins. Exodus 15 and verse 11. Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? And this is Moses and the Israelites singing. Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders? And then it tells of the things he did. But all those phrases, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working in wonders, you see, Moses was having as hard a time encircling this concept as I am and as other human beings have had. All those words have something to do with it, and if you put it in your Vitamix and pulsed it for a while, you'd come up with approximately the right definition. In Job and chapter 5 and verse 9, Job has his own take on this. My Bible's getting to the old point where the pages don't turn so well. This is actually Eliphaz the Temanite, but it's in the book of Job. Job 5 and verse 9, he, meaning God, performs wonders that cannot be fathomed. And that's part of what I'm talking about. Things that we know about, but we don't know about. You know, it says in Ecclesiastes that God has put eternity in the heart of man, except we can't quite grasp it. We don't get it. But it says he performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. And then he talks about bestowing rain on the earth and water and other things. And Job, you know, Job had his own story. God had a special relationship with Job, and we'll come back to that at some point, and a special way of working with Job that involves this path of wonder that we're talking about. But before that, of course, God made humankind. God made Adam and Eve and their descendants. And some of these people have been led down this path of wonder and have approached God and become his children and become friends with him. And the references to it are a bit vague, and yet you know they're there because you are friends of God and you recognize that kind of thing. It began possibly with Abel. It didn't seem to begin with Adam and Eve, although again, we don't know the end of their particular story, and in a way it hasn't ended yet. But Abel seems to have turned to God. Abel seems, by his working with living things, to have found something that led him into God's way of thinking. And there is some recognition of that. You know the story. But, of course, he died before much could come of that. But then there was the man Enoch. The man Enoch, who was just a couple of generations before the flood. And Enoch walked with God for a few hundred years. That's all we know. We don't know much more about it than that. But the implication is that other people didn't. And it was a big deal because this was the first person who walked with God. And when God walked with you in those days, God talked to you directly. God appeared to you and fellowshipped with you. I mean, he did it with Abraham. He did it with Moses. God walked with Enoch. We don't know what it involved, but the implication is that not only was Enoch crazy about God and his way of life, but that God was desperate, too, for company at this point. And that God would take the trouble to appear on earth and walk with people, because that's what he wanted. That was what he was in this whole ball game for, was to end up with people who were like him. And when one came along, God did amazing wonders. We know that Enoch's life ended up in a very special way, that his death and end was not like ours. I mean, you can read the story, and we can talk about that kind of thing. Noah, for some reason, turned to God. One of the great miracles of the story of Noah is that Noah appeared, is that at a time when God decided to do what he did in those days, that there was a man named Noah who was righteous enough to be part of the story. And God didn't make Noah righteous. Noah turned to God for some reason at that point. I wonder if Jesus and God the Father didn't even marvel at that, that when they needed it, it was there. Some vestige of the goodness that God had created the universe with, or maybe Enoch had even had an effect at that time, because Noah probably knew Enoch and certainly knew his son and his father, if you look at the genealogies. By the time Abraham came along, Josephus has something to tell us. And again, this is extra biblical, and yet it's Josephus quotes writers that were much closer to the time of Abraham. And it seems that one of the reasons that Abraham came to God was he looked up at the heavens. And the heavens play a big role in igniting this wonder in people's hearts. I mean, many of us look at stars and are just terribly inspired by the things that happen in the heavens. And it'll be that way even at the time when Jesus Christ returns, that there will be signs and wonders in the heavens that we'll be agog at. But at this time, Abraham, apparently in Ur, and the Chaldeans were known to be astronomers at this time, and Abraham, according to Josephus, was well aware of the science of astronomy at that point and was as learned as many of the astronomers. And the way some people tell the story is that because he realized the Chaldeans were wicked, that he turned his back on all that and decided that the stars had a master and that the master was God, and that's how he knew. And it was that astronomy was wrong, but he would turn to right, and it was God. Well, I don't think it was that way at all. I think Abraham was probably so inspired by what he saw in the heavens, and it was crude compared to what we can just pull up on our iPads today by punching in a few letters and numbers. And yet Abraham was inspired enough that God could work with him at that point. Remember, God had tried to work with Abraham's father Terah, but it didn't take. I mean, there's a sign that God actually contacted Terah and that they were in touch with each other. But it was the son Abraham who sought God out and wanted to know what he could do to be part of God's way of life. You can read Josephus, you can read the story of Abraham. I think it was the astronomy that directly led Abraham to God. Let's go to Psalm 8, because there was a very famous friend of God who wrote this, and it's about this very topic that we're talking about today. Psalm 8, a psalm of David. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. From the lips of children and infants you have ordained praise. Remember that. Because of your enemies, to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? Why do you care? Why do you go to all this trouble? There must be something about man that makes it worth it. You have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him rule over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds and beasts of the fields, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and all that swim the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And all these works David had on his mind and turned him to God. But you can picture him. He talks about flocks and herds. You can picture him tending the flocks, because we know he did that as an impressionable young person who was finding his own path of wonder. And by the time that he was called, God said, no, this is the one. This is someone I can work with. This is someone who's a person after my own heart. I hope God would say that about each of us, but we know that he did say that about David. But notice the rest of this psalm. It's not just David looking at the sky and wondering why God cares, but you see that there's another side to Psalm 8, that God cares too. That human beings give God reason to wonder, and reason to marvel, and reason to love, and reason to seek out their company. God calls us friends in verses that we'll be reading this Passover. If you turn to John 15, these are some of the last things that Jesus said before he was crucified. John 15 and verse 15. Jesus said, I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything I have learned from my Father I have made known to you. Is there any higher compliment that could be paid to us, or cause of wonder, that God wants us to be friends? And servants don't know what God is doing, and the implication is that God wants his friends to know what he is doing. We mostly know what God is doing by observing his holy days, because it's written out in that annual plan what God is doing. But God also cares. David was not just marveling at the stars, he was marveling that God was mindful. And he was a man after God's own heart. In Hebrews 11 and verse 6, this is the faith chapter, but this path to wonder is described. In Hebrews 11 and verse 6, there's many specific examples about the people we've been talking about and how they came to God and how they had great faith. But in Hebrews 11 and verse 6, it gives the formula. By faith, Enoch, and Enoch was a special person, this is in verse 5, was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away, because God held him in the special regard that he holds a very close friend. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God, and that's why God could walk with him. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Must believe that God exists. Something has to turn you along that path. And you have to believe that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Notice what it does not mention. Very important things that it doesn't mention. It doesn't mention anything about keeping commandments. We know that if we love God, we will keep his commandments. That is part of it. And that seeking him, earnestly seeking him, involves wanting to live his way and to please him. And so the commandments are very much a part of that. I'm not at all saying that we can ignore the commandments. We have to do the things the way God wants us to do it. It doesn't mention sacrifice. It doesn't mention repentance. It doesn't mention things like that. It just mentions that anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. And the reason it says that is because that's what God can't make in a human being. When that happens, and we're having at least one baptism today, and what that means is that a person has sought out God and has come to that point. And although God can sow the seed and turn the odds in his favor and guide people along the way, that seeking God, believing that he exists and rewarding those who earnestly seek him, is a miracle in God's eyes. That's why angels rejoice at that point. That's why God rejoices. Because he didn't do that. That's something that a person did. And that is a cause of wonder and awe and transcendence and numinousness for God at that point. I was... When you read about the story of Enoch, it seems that God is hungry to walk with someone at that point. God really wants to be with his friends. And when you come to the last part of Job, and you know, you wonder, you know the story of Job, and we're not going to go over it because you know it, that Job was a man at the very beginning who dedicated his whole life to God, and God rewarded him. He was a very, very rich man. But for reasons that had to do with their friendship and their relationship, God let Satan take those things away from Job. This is a story that, as I said, I'm counting on you knowing if you don't read the book of Job. But how does the book of Job end? How is this resolved? What does God do when he wants to put Job's mind in the exact right frame? Does he say, here's the way I operate. Here are my rules. Here's what you need to do. Here's the reason I did this. No, he doesn't. At the end of the book of Job, we encounter some awe-inspiring verses. And at the end of the book of Job, God appears to Job in a whirlwind. And God starts talking to Job out of the storm in Job 38, starting in verse 1. First, he says about Job and his friends, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me." But does he question Job about theology? Does he question Job about commandments and righteousness and about God's government and the proper form of government and the proper way to keep feast days and things like that? He doesn't. Because he wants Job to follow that path of wonder to him. And so he says, "Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation?" He says, "Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. You've had a lot to say at this point. Who stretched a measuring line across it? Or what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy?" And God doesn't answer all the questions that he asks Job. But what he does is he sweeps Job's problems away with things that lead him down a path of wonder. He talks about his creation. He talks about the things that he has made, about clouds and about lightning and about the stars in verse 31. "Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Did you do that? I did that." And in verse 39 he said, "Do you know when the mountain goats give birth?" I read that verse when I was in forestry school at the University of Montana, and I thought to myself, well, yeah, I just read a paper on that. I mean, we know when the mountain goats give birth. But Job didn't at that point. Job was... people didn't know that kind of thing, that there were many, many more mysteries. We still have mysteries today. You know, our scientific knowledge has improved, but he talks about how all the different animals... live their life without help from man, and the various awe-inspiring things that they do in verse 26 of verse 39. Well, first, he's talked about the war horse in verse 19 and the majestic being that horse is. And then in verse 26, he says, "Does the hawk take flight for your wisdom and spread his wings toward the south? Did you do that? Did you engineer that?" No, a hawk does it all by himself without your help. "Does the eagle soar at your command and build his nest on high?" Then the Lord said to Job in chapter 40, "Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him." And Job, at this point, knows enough. He says in verse 4, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I've already spoken, but I'm not going to say any more." And he sat back and waited for the Lord to go on. And God did go on. He said, "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me." And then he starts talking about other things like justice and condemnation and thunder and an arm. But then he comes down to verse 15 and he says, "Look at Behemoth." And then in verse chapter 41 and verse 1, he says, "Can you pull in Leviathan with a fish hook?" And these were magnificent monsters that apparently God had made, and we don't know what they are. We have some clues. And it seems like Job knew what they were. But at this point, you know, this was written down for us to see. All we can do is wonder. Because this is the voice of God talking. He's talking about things he knows about, and we don't know what he's talking about. He's showing us that there is much more than we know. And that sense of wonder that inspires us is part of the reason that we just bow down and worship before God. So at the end of Job, the way that God brings Job back his line is he blows him away with all the wonderful things that he has done. He's no longer reasoning. He's just saying, this is the way it is. Observe and be my friend. Understand. God gives rules and patterns that bring us to him. He does give us commandments. I mean, we are Sabbath keepers. That's one of the things we do. And yet, God doesn't say in the Bible that he wants a world full of Sabbath keepers. What he says is he wants godly offspring. And keeping the Sabbath and keeping his commandments are things that make us God's offspring. There are things that people cannot, that God cannot do, that people can do. People can write a psalm like Psalm 8. God could not write that psalm. If God set out to write psalms, God would write very good psalms. I'm willing to believe that. And it seems that there are parts of the psalms that God did directly inspire the lyrics to. And yet there are many things that human beings do that God cannot do. And that's not a reflection of God having any weakness or anything like that. It's that God can make things that can do incredible works of art or accomplishments or buildings. He said himself at the Tower of Babel that there's nothing they can't do if they put their minds together. And I can only think that God enjoys seeing that in your own lives. And it's why in our day-to-day lives, we try to fill our lives with details that add goodness and wonder and marvelous things to the world. One of my obsessions is that I like fountain pens. I really do. I like writing with a fountain pen. I have enough fountain pens now, and I have enough ink to last me from now till several centuries after I am dead. My children can divide it up in the way that they feel is fit. But one of the companies that I truly enjoy doing business with is a company called Goulet Pens. And Goulet doesn't make any pens. They're just a reseller, and they are good at publicizing things. They have great videos, and they can tell you how to take care of your pens. But the reason I like Goulet pens is simple, besides the fact that they have good products and good prices, is that when I get a box from Goulet pens, in the bottom it says, "Have a good time writing with this," and it's signed by someone, and then there's that Tootsie Pop in the bottom of the box, which costs about 1.5 cents. And if you're interested in good health, you probably shouldn't eat that Tootsie Pop. May I say that I always eat the Tootsie Pop at that point, that I unwrap it and I think, I haven't had one of these since the last time I got a box from Goulet Pens. But it reminds us of our childhood, and it reminds us of wonderful things that we're not expecting. And, you know, life can be full of that kind of thing. Yes, the world is a place full of horrible evils and horrible wars and horrible things that people do to people and that people do to animals and that people do to the earth. It's a terrible, terrible place. But the miracle is that there's so much goodness. I was very happy in that excellent sermonette to hear Mr. Housen talk about man's propensity to do good and man's propensity to do evil. God has created us to be creators in his own fashion, and we can use that to do good, we can use it to do evil. We're not created as vile, evil things, but we have those choices. Unfortunately, at a young age, we start making those choices, but also at that young age, we start to see things in the world, and some of us get drawn to God because of that. God rejoices in the wonderful things that people can do. Why else would he be doing all this? God likes people. He likes to be with people. He likes to walk with people. He's not so desperate anymore that he comes down to earth and walks with us. But you know very well that God works in the details of your own life. Sometimes in ways that if you were to explain it to somebody, they would go, I'm not seeing that at all. But the way God works it out in your life, you see it. And you know that it could come from nowhere else. It's one of the little tricks that God plays, if I may use that term, is that sometimes he works out our lives in very amazing coincidences. Wonder and awe and numinousness and transcendence in some ways is the inspiration for all the arts everything that has ever been done. Because why paint a picture of something if you can't make it better in some way, if you can't make it glow in a certain way, if you can't represent it in a certain way? Why tell a story or make a movie if you can't impart something with that? Every one of the arts has its foundation in that desire to pursue the path of wonder. Jesus responded to this when he was on the earth, when he finally came as a man. He enjoyed people's reactions to the good things in life. One of the things that he enjoyed, as you know, was children. He loved to be surrounded by them. In one case, we know that there was a child on his lap. He loved to tell stories and say how wonderful children were. And he liked to say that there's no way we're going to be friends with him unless we become like children. Now, those of you with children, if you would please cover your children's ears at this point. I don't want them to know that children do this better than we do. It won't work. Marissa already suspects this. Children follow the path of wonder better than we do. And that's why there's videos on YouTube of children getting a present and seeing their reaction. Or seeing their reaction when their brother Charlie bites their finger, or things like that. There are many videos of the wonderful reactions of children. God made kids cute and wonderful. Otherwise, I won't say that, but otherwise it'd be tempting, wouldn't it? I mean, to just walk out and shut the door sometimes. But God makes them in a way that we want to take care of them. One of the reasons that we know how God feels about us is how we feel about children. Because these children have a sense of wonder in them. That's one of the differences between children and grown-ups, is that it seems to disappear in the grown-ups. There's some of us who are so immature that that's absolutely no danger. And our congregation is full of them, I'm happy to say. And many of my friends are that way. But Jesus responded to these children. And remember, one of the reasons I was rebuilding my childhood was that childhood is the time of wonder. Jesus was astonished by some other things. You know, in Matthew 8, and you can read it yourself because you know the story, but there was a centurion. This man was not a Jew. He didn't live like a Jew. He didn't really even keep God's laws, although we have a feeling that he probably turned at this point because he seemed to have a certain intrinsic respect for Jesus and he was drawn to Jesus. And a beloved servant of his was ill, and Jesus said, "It's okay, I will come to your house and I will heal this man." And the centurion said, "You don't have to do that. You're in charge of the whole universe. All you have to do, I'm not even worthy that you should come in my house. There's no reason for you to do that. But the way things are set up, all you have to do is say the word and my servant will be healed." Jesus was astonished. He hadn't found that in any of the Jews. It surprised him. It delighted him. It took him aback. And of course, the servant was healed. But the story in the Bible, and it's mentioned more than once, is that Jesus was astonished at this man. And it was one of the things that made him realize why he was doing the things that he was doing. Let's turn to Matthew 15. There is a story that's a little less known, but I think you do know it, and it appears twice in the Bible. But in Matthew 15, there's a story of a Canaanite woman. She's called Syrophoenician. She's from the area of Tyre and Sidon. And there's slightly different details, but we'll read it in Matthew. Matthew 15 and verse 21. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. He was trying to get away from the hubbub of where the Jews lived. He was trying to take a break. Jesus didn't get too many breaks, and people came to him. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him, crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession." This woman not only loved her daughter, but she knew enough about Jesus to know that he could help her. Jesus didn't answer a word. He ignored her. It was people wonder why he would be so insulting to this person. She wasn't a Jew, and yet she was a human being. His disciples came to him and urged him, saying, "Please send her away. She keeps crying out after us. She won't leave us alone. She's so persistent about this." And he answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." Now, he wouldn't say that if it wasn't true. But the woman came and knelt before him, and she said, "Lord, help me." She was desperate. stuck with his story. He said, it isn't right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. What if someone said that to you? What if you asked a favor of someone and they said, I don't do that for dogs? That's pretty serious and pretty down-putting. What did the woman say? She said, yes, Lord. But even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. And you wonder how much of this, you know, Jesus was setting up to see what the reaction would be. When Jesus answered, woman, you have great faith, exclamation point, your request is granted. So he was able to help those who were not part of the lost children of Israel. But he was learning more about her. And I bet he would have wanted to spend more time with her, a woman of that much faith who would take these insults and yet still stay humble and still stay on this path directly to God. The present was that her daughter was healed from that very hour. Jesus liked people. Jesus hoped for friendship. One of the best gifts that God gave to Jesus was the 12 yahoos who went around with him for 3.5 years. They in some ways were very dense, blockheaded people, just like all the rest of us. And he did not refrain from making jokes at their expense. But at the same time, there was love there. And you know that when in John 6, and let's turn there, when Jesus had faced some very difficult personal things. In John 6 and verse 66, he had talked very clearly about certain parts of his life and that his coming sacrifice, and this is where it's talking about eating the flesh of the Son of Man and drinking the blood. In verse 66, it says, from this time many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. So people whom Jesus had invested in, people whom he had already walked with and already spent time with, turned their back on him when things got down to the wire. And you can see the hope and the wishes in Jesus' heart by the next thing that he says to the 12, these men whom God gave to him. He said, you do not want to leave me too, do you? Not knowing what the answer would be. And Simon Peter, who never was at a loss for words, well, maybe once, said, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, the words of life. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. And that's almost a direct paraphrase of that pattern in Hebrews 11. Jesus knew at that point that Peter was on that road, even though Peter was to give him much more trouble before the end would come. And Jesus, although he had the friendship of these people, it doesn't mean that he felt very good at that point, because the next thing he says is, well, I'm the one who chose you 12, and yet one of you is a devil. In other words, I can't seem to do anything right. I mean, in some ways, he acted just like a human, go figure. But he liked people. He did hope for their friendship. He bothered to heal a man with a legion of demons. He went out of his way to do it and to talk to him afterwards. He bothered to change the life of an adulterous woman and didn't condemn her and told her to change her behavior and go on. He bothered to contact tax collectors and say, follow me. And they did. Because not only did people want to come to Jesus, but Jesus wanted to come to people at that point. What was it like when John the Baptist suddenly appeared on the scene? And then his cousin Jesus. Well, there were always men and women in the history of God's people whose hearts have been on fire and who followed this path to wonder. But at that time, there was a huge contrast between John and the speakers that they were used to hearing. I would just venture to guess that the speakers were boring, that they were very priestly, that they probably had their formulas and their laws. And that seems to be what we find with the Sadducees and the Pharisees. There were people who were exciting, but they were dangerous. They were called zealots, and they were frowned on. They were at the fringes of society. But at that time, a man named John, whom we call John the Baptizer, came apparently out of nowhere and started saying things that people would leave their homes and go out into the desert and the wilderness to hear, without food, without shelter. They were so desperate to hear these words of life that they would give up all kinds of things to do it. And they did the same thing when Jesus spoke. And yes, it is true, and Jesus even acknowledged that some were just responding to the miracles, which Jesus called wonders. Some are responding to the food. He really does say most of these people are here for the food. And it does appear to be a pattern. But every now and then, he got to see people overwhelmed with wonder. In Mark 9, and this is recorded in more than one place, but in Mark 9, this is right after he and Peter and James and John have come down from the mountain and the meeting with Elijah and Moses. And it's recorded in a couple places when he got back. That story is over. And in Mark 9, in verse 14, the story goes on. He's coming back to civilization. Instead of getting to, you know, I come home from work and I like to be alone for like a half hour and become a normal, nice person. I remember one time after Sabbath services, our son was a little guy and he was walking around with this stick. And there was a ball on the end of a stick. And this was probably in the early 90s, which meant that I came home from Sabbath services mad a lot of times. And I would sit in a chair and just kind of radiate glowering anger. And he walked past me at one point on one of those Sabbaths and he said, "Poof, now you're a nice man." And I always remember those times. And you know, Jesus had a lot of stress. This time on the mountain was a very inspiring thing for him. But still, he came back and he's plunged right back into the same old stress. And it says in verse 14, when they came to the other disciples, because, you know, nine of them were still there, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. And of course, we can read about all those other things, and you can see Jesus' stress at this point because he calls them, "Oh, unbelieving generation." But at the same time, Jesus did see that these people were overwhelmed with wonder. And one of the greatest reactions, one of the most wonderful reactions that we get to read in the Bible took place shortly after his crucifixion. And it's in the last part of Luke. And in Luke chapter 24, it's the story of the two men on the road to Emmaus who are met by a third person. And you know, this third person turns out to be the resurrected Jesus Christ, even though they didn't recognize him. And they're sad. You know the story. I can't go through it all. But in verse 25, Jesus says to them, and he's, am I allowed to say jerking their chain in church? He's giving them a hard time here. Verse 25, Jesus says to them, "How foolish you are and how slow of heart." And these are men who think they've given their whole lives to following this. "To believe all that the prophets," how slow of heart you are to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Didn't the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? So Jesus is still saying, will they ever get it? But beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. He went through the whole story so that they could repeat it to others, and then he disappeared. And they tried to get him to stay with them, and he did go into the inn with them, but then after he took bread and gave thanks and broke it, their eyes were open, they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. But it's the next thing they say in verse 32 that I want to look at. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" And that's the best summary of people's reactions to Jesus' words in the whole Bible. Didn't our hearts burn within us when that man explained things to us? As Peter said, he had the words of life. Why is any of this important at all? It's important because we have a message to preach to the world, and we're doing our very best to do it in the way that we've been taught how, and we're pouring our resources into it, and we're getting good results. There are baptisms, there are people coming, there are people whose lives are changed, there are people who are already in God's church whose lives are being supported. So we're doing what we can do, but it isn't enough because it's very small. Can I just say that? We're doing our best, we're getting results, we are praying to God, and yet for some reason, God isn't giving us the thousands and thousands of people that sometimes showed up in his family in one day around the time when Jesus died. Or the 150,000 that were around at the end of one of the manifestations of the church that we've been a part of. At that time, it was called Worldwide Church of God. Now, we shouldn't be too discouraged by the numbers, because there's still, as God said to Elijah, there's still people out there who haven't bowed the knee. We just don't know where they are. They're scattered in so many places. But numbers aren't what we need. But I still think that if we're going to do an end-time work that's going to reach the whole world, we're going to have to take into account this path of wonder. Our instructions at this time that come from the Old Testament prophets, but talking about our time, are that we have to build the house of God and build it out of people whose hearts burn for God and who will be godly offspring, people who will cause even God to be inspired by the fact that they have turned to Him. We need to do it with this path to wonder. If we just do it with the Bible, and of course there's absolutely, I am 100% in favor of preaching the Bible because it's how we know about God. But think about it. For two-thirds of mankind's history, I mean, if we say that civilization has been around 6,000 years, but let's just do vague numbers. For two-thirds of history, there was no Bible the way that we have it. And some of God's best friends, Enoch, Abraham, David, you could almost say Paul, really didn't have the Bible that we had. And yet somehow the word got out and somehow people followed the path of wonder. So we have to go beyond the Bible and we have to find these paths that lead into people's minds, whether they're wooden cubes or trees in a Disney movie. And you know, people have found it. People have successfully found those paths, and one of them I've already mentioned was Walt Disney. Walt Disney changed the world. I know people who go to Disney World every year. I know a person who just had a baby. She named the baby Elsa, no comment. And I'll comment, that's out of a Disney movie. And Elsa has already gone to Disney World more times than I have, which is none, but I'm not bitter, Mom and Dad. Elsa has been to Disney World 3 times because this woman doesn't want her to grow up without Disney in her life. People are nuts for that kind of thing, but what did Walt Disney do? He lit that path of wonder. I remember the first time I saw, because I grew up in the 50s and 60s, my childhood was Disney dominated. I remember the first movie I saw was Pinocchio, and I saw that blue fairy, and I was in love. I'd never seen anything as beautiful as that blue fairy. And now, of course, the blue fairy looks pretty ragged. It's just light on a screen, and I'm more immune to that. But Walt Disney drew people in and gave them dreams. We used to play Peter Pan, and my parents would say, no, you can't jump off the roof. But we wanted to fly. We really did. I don't know what inspires the children today, but Disney's still going strong. You look at Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs inspired people. All he did was sell products, computers, which other people sold, and phones, which other people sold, and music players, which other people sold. And yet, people are passionate. People wait in lines. They camp for days to get these things. He inspired the world because he knew what led into people's minds and what would turn them on. And of course, in both the case of Walt Disney and Steve Jobs, they also made a few billion dollars off of this kind of thing. And their budgets are bigger than the gross national products of many nations in the world. And today, of course, Apple Computer and Disney are two huge companies. But they found the path to wonder. We need to present God's story with that same kind of thing. And I don't know how to do it. I pray to God all the time. I don't think it's going to be my generation that does it. I think it's going to be the next generation. So I'm being nice to your kids. Because in some ways, I think the burden is going to be on them. Again, as I said, we're doing their best. But I'm going to give you a bit of homework. And it's easy, and I think you'll like it. On March 26, which was only 2 days ago, Mr. Victor Kubik, posted something on a blog on the site members.ucg.org. And it's called Think Different. And I will say that after 40-some years in the church, it gives me great glee to see the president of the organization that I am very happily a part of saying that Apple Computer knows a lot of things that we don't know. And the Think Different is a wonderful slogan, and that we need to think different. And there's a video. If you just Google Victor Cubic and Think Different, the first thing you'll come up with, because I did it this morning, is this video. And what this video does is it recreates an ad that Apple ran in 1997 with Richard Dreyfuss narrating, but it took the voice of Richard Dreyfuss out of it, and it substituted Steve Jobs. Now, Steve Jobs died a couple years ago, as you know, or maybe more than that at this point. But it becomes all the more inspiring when you hear him and about the need there is in this world to think different. And I want you to watch that video, and I want you to contact me and tell me if there wasn't a tear in your eye. You got your bulletins? Hold up your bulletins. Everybody hold up your bulletins. In your bulletins is my phone number and my email address. I want to hear from you. I want you to watch that video and let me know what you thought, and you'll see what I'm talking about. As God's friends and children, we need to have wonder in our lives. We need to light that fire in the world. We need to give the world the words of life. We need to make the world wonder.